Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 230, 101 Exercises for the Soul with Bernie Siegel, MD.
Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast with your host, Dr. Dave. Coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area, Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
In order to know who you are, you really need a still water. So the ugly duckling realizes he's a swan, and Campbell shares a story where a tiger dies giving birth and chasing some goats. So the goats take over the baby and raise it. And it thinks it's a goat. It doesn't know it's not a tiger, you know. Until another tiger comes along and says to him, "Hey, dumbbell, you're a tiger. You're not a goat. Come with me." And Campbell goes on to say, he takes him to a still pond and says, "Look, you're a tiger." And it's like meditation and yoga. And that's why I try to help people heal their lives. You know, find that quiet, find their authenticity, because that's when the body gets an incredible live message.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Bernie Siegel, one of the pioneers of mind-body medicine. Bernie Siegel, MD, is a well-known proponent of alternative approaches to healing that heal not just the body, but the mind and soul as well. His 2005 book, 101 Exercises for the Soul, has just been released in paperback. Bernie, as his friends and patients call him, studied medicine at Colgate University and Cornell University Medical College. His surgical training took place at Yale New Haven Hospital, West Haven Veterans Hospital, and the Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh. In 1979, Bernie pioneered a new approach to group and individual cancer therapy called ECAP, for exceptional cancer patients. His innovative methods used patients' drawings, dreams, and feelings and broke new ground in facilitating important lifestyle changes while engaging patients in the healing process. Bernie retired from general and pediatric surgical practice in 1989. Always a strong advocate for his patients, Bernie has since dedicated himself to humanizing the medical establishment's approach to patients and empowering individuals to play a greater role in the healing process. He's an active speaker traveling around the world to address patient and caregiver groups. As the author of several books, including Love, Medicine, and Miracles, 365 Prescriptions for the Soul, Smudge and Bunny, and Faith, Hope, and Healing, Bernie has been at the forefront of the medical ethics and spiritual issues of our day. He and his wife, Bobby, live in a suburb in Connecticut. They have 5 children and 8 grandchildren. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Bernie Siegel, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you, Dave.
Well, for some time, you've been one of the most visible pioneers in what might be called mind-body medicine. In Joseph Campbell's terms, when did you get the call?
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned his name. We'll get to him again.
Okay, good.
Because he's really one of my teachers. But I think it had a lot to do with why I chose medicine, meaning that I chose it for healthy reasons. I liked people, wanted to help them fix things, loved science. So, you know, but when I say that, there are a lot of doctors who love the human body and science and then have trouble because people come in your body. You know, it's like a veterinarian said to me when I said, it's too painful being a doctor, I'm going to become a veterinarian. He said, don't, people bring the pets in. So, you know, he got me to focus on people. And when I went to a conference that I thought was for doctors in terms of its title and caring for cancer patients.
Yes.
When I got there, there were only 3 doctors, 2 of whom were psychotherapists and myself out of 125 people. And my patients were sitting there, and this sentence changed my life. She said, "You're a nice guy. I feel better when I'm in the office with you, but I can't take you home with me. So I need to know how to live between office visits." Boom.
Yeah, wow.
That, you know, just refocused my life and my direction, because I suddenly realized I don't have to be in pain all the time when I can't cure something. I can help somebody live with it. And literally, when I got back to the office, one of my partners said to me, "You're gone." I said, "What do you mean I'm gone?" He said, "You're totally different." I mean, this was a weekend workshop, you know, Friday to Sunday. But he said, "You know, you're a different person, and you're going to leave surgery." And it took, let's see, the meeting was in, I think, 1978. And in 1989, I left the practice to go out and just keep helping people and lecturing and teaching.
Interesting. Now, was that before or after you developed a cancer program that I think you called ECAP, Exceptional Cancer Patients? Do I have that right?
Well, that meeting is what got me to start ECAP.
Uh-huh.
Because the meeting, I think, was like in the spring, you know, summer. And so I said, good, in the fall, you know, when people are back from vacations, we'll start ECAP. Now, I didn't have a title for it at first, and I'll tell you how the title came. But we sent out 100 letters to our patients from our office saying, "Do you want to live a longer, better life? Come to a meeting." After I mailed the letter, I realized, dumbbell, you didn't say it's only for your patients. So they're going to bring their friends and relatives, and you're going to have 300 and 500 people, and what are you going to do with them? Well, less than a dozen women showed up.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's when my wife labeled them exceptional. So it became Exceptional Cancer Patients, which, of course, then caused a problem in the sense that people who grow up unloved with guilt, shame, and blame from all the authorities in their life see the word exceptional, and it's like, well, I'm not exceptional, so I can't go to the meeting.
Yeah.
And to me, what I really learned is it's letting people know that we all have that potential to be exceptional, you know, to exceed expectation.
Well, what were the elements of the program as you began to develop it?
Well, first of all, I'm a surgeon, and there are several oncologists in town who said to me, "You don't know what the hell you're doing. You know, you may make these people feel worse." And I thought, I'm not going to make them feel worse. I may not help them feel better. So I read a lot of books on psychology, psychiatry, and then we sat down, and I realized what I needed to do is shut up and listen, because they were living the experience. You see, I was the tourist in the room.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to say that basically what I share now is what I've learned from all of them. You know, what I call survival behavior,
mm-hmm.
you know, and empowerment. I mean, that these are people who participate in their life and in their decisions and fulfill a certain personality. And so I see myself now as a coach trying to get others to act and behave as if they're the person they want to become. Let me add this.
Yeah.
I mean, this ultimately ties in with a lifetime because, again, I don't make up these stories. A quote, "My mother's words were eating away at me and maybe gave me cancer." So it's not just treating the cancer, but treating all the things her mother said to her, that she dressed her in dark clothes so nobody would notice, told that she's a failure. I mean, and then there's worse, you know, where parents tell you to commit suicide, abuse you, totally reject you. So it's all those wounds that people are living with. And it's hard to get that group to care about themselves. And that's what I try to do, in a sense, reparent them, let them know I love them. And then hopefully they will come to realize they're worth something and begin to take care of themselves.
Well, that's fascinating. I was struck by your use of the, by your saying that you're serving as a coach these days, because that seems to be a metaphor that's really caught on.
Well, it's really, the word doctor, I think, is derived from teacher. So that's what we're really here to do, is to teach, to coach.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so that in a sense, criticism is not a bad thing. It's call it feedback, you know, if the word criticism has a negative meaning to people. But again, if you're playing ball or in a play and the director or the coach says, hold it, you know, and tells you how to do it better, you don't walk away saying, oh, I'm terrible. And the same when you're confronting a disease, that it's what kind of attitude, what can I do, what can empower me? And it is the people who become what I call the characters, you know, who speak up. They don't become victims. And they're not fighting a war. That's something on my website, which is Bernie Siegel, SIEGELMD.com. I have an article, Waging a War Against Cancer, because Mother Teresa taught me something. She was invited to an anti-war rally, and she refused to attend, and the people were very disappointed. So they turned to walk away, and she said, but if you ever have a peace rally, call me. And that's what I'm trying to help people do, heal their lives.
Yes.
You see, Monday morning, we had more heart attacks, strokes, suicides, and illnesses. So it's fairly obvious how your health is affected by, you know, things you don't like to do. So your body responds. And I say that in the sense that the body is interpreting. You're unhappy with life. Your body says, hey, we'll get you into the hospital. You don't have to go to work, or you'll be dead tomorrow and you don't have to get up and worry about all this. So your body is interpreting what you're telling it. And so are your genes, for that matter. And people have to realize that the genes don't make a decision. So, I mean, things that I was criticized for decades ago are now scientific. From things like loneliness, cancer patients who laugh live longer. Loneliness affects the genes which control immune function. If you play music in an operating room, which I did and was called an explosion hazard for bringing in a tape recorder, but it now shows that you need fewer drugs, people wake up more comfortably, the operation goes faster. I mean, these are simple little things, but it shows that you can't separate mind and body. And as our belief systems change, then the research begins to change and support these things.
Yeah, and there really has been quite an evolution of research in recent years. I'm wondering to what extent you might have been influenced, if at all, by the work of Carl Simonton and his wife.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he got me started.
I wondered about that. Yeah.
Yeah, as a surgeon, I just talked to his daughter recently because she's doing a little film on him. But the first weekend was basically Carl Simonton when I talked to you about that workshop. I mean, I can't remember the exact title, but when you read the title, as I said, my assumption was he's here to teach doctors, and no doctors showed up. But the thing that really blew my mind, I'm an artist in the sense of a painter, and that's part of why I went into surgery as a kid. I didn't know you could be an artist and earn a living selling what you painted. So I thought, you got good hands, you really ought to use them. So surgery seemed like a natural choice. But Carl said, we're going to do guided imagery. And I thought, this is nonsense. I didn't come here for this craziness. I came to learn things.
Yeah, you're a New Yorker, right? Native.
Yeah. So he started doing this, and I'm sitting there just watching him. And then he looked at me, and I thought, oh, my God, he knows I'm not doing it. So I shut my eyes. Now I'll fool him.
Yeah.
And then the images were incredible. Because I'm a visual person. So as soon as I shut my eyes, boy, was I convinced. And another person that I worked with, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, let me jump back a minute. But one of the things I learned, you know, because of Carl, that, you know, early on the imagery was have packed men eating cancer cells. But again, just as I said before, it doesn't have to be a violent, you know, you don't need a German shepherd chewing up a tumor. You can have the tumor be a block of ice and God's light melted.
Mm-hmm.
I had a Quaker friend with cancer who refused treatment because the doctor said, I'm going to kill your cancer. He said, I don't kill anything, and he walked out. And when I got him to draw a picture, he's carrying his cancer cells away. He doesn't want to hurt anything. And the other person, as I mentioned, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, I drew a picture for her, one of her workshops. And it's an outdoor scene. To me, it didn't represent anything except the scene I saw when I did my guided imagery. So I had a picture of my guide, George, that was his name, and some other symbols in it, some trees and a mountain. And Elizabeth looks at this picture and says, what are you covering up? I said, what are you talking about? She said, you put snow on the mountain. I said, yeah, it's a mountain with snow. She said, Bernie, the page is white. You took a white crayon and added a layer. What are you covering up? And it was all my emotions and feelings.
Hmm.
And then, why is 12 important? Oh, I've been doing this for 12 months. And, I mean, I look at this picture and I thought, holy smokes. I mean, how does all this get into this picture? You know, we'll think about your dreams, you know,
yes.
How much can come up. But again, you see, with Carl, with Elizabeth. I went back to the hospital with crayons and said to all the patients, draw pictures. And it was amazing, again, what was revealed, because I knew anatomy. Literally, people drew their diagnosis, what was going on within them. Or if you said, draw yourself in the operating room, it told me what that procedure meant to them. And I still have never met a doctor who, while in medical school, was told that Carl Jung interpreted a dream many decades ago and made a diagnosis of a brain tumor from a dream. See?
I wasn't aware of that story. I'm kind of a Jungian myself, but I was not aware of that.
To tell people, you know, doctors those things, so they'll talk to patients. And as I say, the anatomy, I mean, I show, you know, slides when I lecture, and people sometimes laugh because you see the symbolism, the body parts, and you don't have to be a doctor to realize it. And then they go home with a very different feeling and thought. But our lives are stored in us, too. You know, we transplant organs, and the recipient has memories from the life of the donor of the organ. So people need to understand that, and above all, that consciousness is not a local phenomenon. It's not limited to the body, and that all these things play a part in patients' lives and their response to doctors. Well, another study, then maybe I'll take a breath if you have another question. But it was in the – I don't keep track of every journal where I read these, because it's like if I see something I agree with, I go, oh, yeah. This was patients who had infections and colds. Those who had a compassionate doctor recovered one day sooner than those who didn't have a compassionate doctor. So, again, you begin to see how – the attitude of the healthcare professional makes a hell of a difference in the recovery of the patient.
Yes.
And our words, too.
You
can kill people with words. That I've learned. Take their hope away, they go home and die. And I never had a problem doing what I call deceiving people into health. You know, giving them hope and giving them something to believe in.
Now, some people would talk about the placebo effect, and often that's spoken of in negative terms, but it seems to me that that same idea of the placebo maybe is what you're talking about.
Yes, it shows us the power. See, well, you know, I keep thinking, when you watch TV or listen to the radio, you know, you hear a commercial for a drug, and they tell you this is good for your headache. But if, you know, it also, if you take it, you know, and you're pregnant, this will happen. Your fingers could fall off, your hair, they go into all the possible problems. Now, if that's all you heard, you'd say, I'm never going to take that thing. And that's what doctors tend to do. They say, you know, we're going to give you chemotherapy, you go into the operating room, and here's the problems. They don't say, this can make you well, and you can be, you know, live for another 25 years. It's, no, this is what will happen to you. And I think, so people go home and have it happen. And this was one of the, see, when I say deceive people into health, especially I did a lot of children's surgery, I would tell parents, get a bottle of vitamins, label it for whatever you want for your child. So it could be anti-nausea, anti-pain, hair-growing pills, and it's amazing how well the kids do because they believe in me and their parents.
Mm-hmm.
And this story just, again, I don't make any of them up. A radiation therapist came up to me. We were at a conference, and he said, boy, I feel terrible. I said, what's the matter? He said, we repaired our radiation therapy machine. A month later, do our routine inspection and discover that there was no radioactive material put back in the machine. So we haven't treated anybody for a month. I said, you don't realize what you're telling me. He said, what do you mean I don't realize what I'm telling you? I said, you'd have to be a total idiot to not realize you weren't treating anyone. So you had tumor shrinking, you had side effects of radiation, because people believed they were being treated. And boy, his eyes bulged out of his head, and he said, oh my God, you're right. Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's a story much like that that goes back to Anton Mesmer that supposedly he forgot to put in the magnetic filings, or his assistant forgot to put in the magnetized filings in the bottles that were supposed to be floating in the tub, and people had the experience anyway, and then that's what led him to conclude, oh, the magic must be in me. It must be animal magnetism.
Yeah, that's why doctors really, as far as I'm concerned, need to be trained in communication. I mean, somebody who helped me a lot was Dr. Milton Erickson.
Oh, yes.
Who, you know, had polio as a child, learned a lot about what, you know, how doctors could be destructive talking to him about his polio. And he learned how powerful words were. And so reading his teaching tales, I learned to tell stories to people.
Yes.
And as I say, and especially the kids, because they believed in me. And so whatever I would say to them, you know, it was just amazing to me how simple it was to hypnotize them. And even under anesthesia, people hear you. So I would tell people, you wake up comfortable, thirsty, and hungry. And they would. But the problem was, my patient started gaining weight. And one of the nurses in my office said, oh, yes, he tells you, you'll wake up hungry. So they started getting mad at me because it's my fault they're gaining weight because they're always hungry. And I realized, you know, just a simple change, you'll wake up hungry but won't finish what's on your plate, took care of the problem. But it just showed how vulnerable patients are under anesthesia. I mean, think if all the surgeon says is, oh, this is the worst case I've ever seen. If they leave here, it'll be feet first, you know. And then you wake up wondering why you're feeling so depressed and tearful because you've heard all those things stated in the operating room.
Yeah, I'll bet you probably know Dr. David Cheek, who's written quite a bit about that.
Yeah. Yeah, I read some of his things. And, you know, you mentioned Joseph Campbell at the beginning. I'm reading and rereading and rereading his work. The one I'm reading now, and the title I thought was very interesting, Reflections on the Art of Living.
Mm-hmm.
I often entitle my lectures The Art of Living and Healing, because I do so much work with dreams and drawings. But the other was the word reflections. In my latest book, Faith, Hope, and Healing, which is Inspiring Lessons from Cancer Patients, after every story, there are Bernie's reflection. And to me, it had to do with two things. One being the role of water. And in order to know who you are, you really need a still water. So the ugly duckling realizes he's a swan. And Campbell shares a story where a tiger dies giving birth and chasing some goats. So the goats take over the baby and raise it. And it thinks it's a goat. It doesn't know it's not a tiger, you know, it's a tiger. Until another tiger comes along and says to him, hey, dumbbell, you're a tiger. You're not a goat. Come with me. And Campbell goes on to say, he takes him to a still pond and says, look, you're a tiger. And it's like meditation and yoga. And that's why I try to help people heal their lives, you know, find that quiet, find their authenticity, because that's when the body gets an incredible live message. In other words, you're living a life imposed on you, and then you learn you have cancer or some other life-threatening illness, and you say, okay, then I'm going to do what I enjoy doing. I'm going to save my true life, and it's amazing how that then adds to longevity or even leads to self-induced healing, because that's a term from Solzhenitsyn in his book Cancer Ward. He uses a symbol, a rainbow-colored butterfly flutters out of the book that one of the men is reading about self-induced healing. See, not what doctors call spontaneous remission, but self-induced.
Yes.
The rainbow-colored butterfly really hit me because, again, the butterfly, symbol of transformation. Every color has a meaning. The rainbow is your life in order. They like the still pond. So you quiet your life, transform into who you're meant to be, and it's amazing. Because then the body says, oh, you love life. Hey, I'll do what I can for you.
Yeah, I like that story that you tell from Joseph Campbell's book.
Oh, he adds some humor to it, too, because when the other tiger shows up and says, you're a tiger, you're not a goat, here's a piece of meat. He says, no, I'm a vegetarian. No. But when he gives him the piece of meat, you see, that's also symbolic. It's like, rah, you know, he's beginning to become his authentic self. He's not a goat. And the other thing that Campbell ends with is that we all need to have that tiger in us. It's okay to dress like a goat so you don't scare people, but keep that tiger, you know, your authentic self alive.
Yeah, yeah. I'm interested in what you do with dreams and drawings. Can you say more about that?
Yeah. I mean, originally, whenever anybody wanted to enter the group, I would ask them to do some drawings, answer some questions, and inquire about their dreams. But the drawings were, I mean, one is draw yourself, your treatment, your immune system, and your disease. Now, those are the instructions. They have all colors available. Give them a full box of crayons, so black, white, brown, and all the rainbow colors. Yourself, your disease, your treatment, your immune system. Then I can sit and look at it.
Yeah, that's great.
Now, some people will put the disease on another part of the page. Okay, then how do you help yourself if it's out there? Or their immune system is looking out in 27 different directions and not surrounding the disease. They're not letting the treatment into their body. Or the other side, too. People say, I don't want chemotherapy. And they draw this beautiful yellow fluid running into their body right to the tumor. And I will say to them, go and get it. You know it's good for you. Intuitively, your intellect is the problem. Or an operating room. You can be lying on the table. So you draw your treatment. And there's nobody in the room to take care of you. And somebody else draws it with God's light shining in the window, family, doctors, you know, everybody around caring for them. And they're much more likely to survive and do well. Now, if you get a negative picture or have a negative dream, I, again, will use imagery to reprogram the person or tell them, hey, you know, if the x-ray machine is a monster and you don't want it, that's up to you. You know, I always say you're trying not to die or do what's right for you. If you're comfortable saying no, okay, that you're not going to be angry at yourself. But if you said, no, I want radiation, all right, then go home and visualize yourself in the operating room, chemotherapy, radiation, whatever, or even eating vegetables, because some people don't like vegetables. They'd rather have an operation than cure their problem. I mean that. It's, you know, when you say draw a picture, I had one picture of the kitchen where everybody's head was at the bottom of the page. And the guy said, I hate the diet I'm on. If I can have medication or chemotherapy, I prefer it. I say, fine, we'll do that for you so you can go home and eat what you want. But again, you can visualize going to the operating room, waking up, feeling well, going home quickly, and doing well. And it's amazing. If people do that three or four times a day for a week or two, you say, draw a new picture, and it's beautiful. It's a total transformation. So they have reprogrammed themselves.
Yeah.
And a lot of this, if people want, because I have them mail it to me and we interpret it, if they go to my website, they'll see, you know, information about how to do that. But what I would say, they don't necessarily even need me. You can draw a picture and then look at it tomorrow with some family members or friends. The reason I say look the next day, then you'll see it as if someone else drew it, because the unconscious blinds you. See, I can draw a picture of my family and try to make sure everybody knows, oh, we're wonderful. And then you look the next day and the kids aren't holding hands, you see. Or maybe their noses are missing, so there's no life, no inspiration. So you notice that the next day, but it's amazing that you don't notice you've left it out when you're drawing it.
Yeah, I think the idea of using drawings in that way is really wonderful. Mm-hmm. It allows them to communicate with you unconsciously. It brings material that might be unconscious out into the open, and also brings emotions into the picture.
Yeah, I mean, another thing that makes it helpful, as I said, I did a lot of children's surgery, that one little boy said the kids are teasing him in the locker room in gym, so would I fix his body? I said, draw yourself in the operating room. And literally, all he used was a black crayon, and he looks like an insect on the operating table, this little black thing. Now, how do I use that drawing? To show his parents. Because I said, what this kid needs is your love. I mean, he could spend his life having plastic surgery and never feel beautiful. Because, you know, he's a speck on this big page. And see, then they don't argue with you. Because the child drew it. I'm not criticizing them. It's their child.
Mm-hmm.
Or another child with cancer. I don't get enough time for my family. There's six people in the family. I could spend the day talking about what do you do all day. But she drew herself sitting on a chair, and the rest of the family was on a sofa with an extra seat that was empty on the sofa. Parents said, thank you, and went home and spent more time with her. So over and over again, what the kids draw, I can show to the parents. And I'll tell you, three quarters of the drawings, when you just walk into school and say to the kids, draw your home and family, three quarters of them are a disaster. I mean, it's not a family. They're not touching. They're not near each other. And the teachers are always amazed how I know so much about these kids, and all they did was draw a picture. Yeah, but they're sharing that information. And it can really help family members to see how that person feels. And as I say, not take it as criticism, but take it as a statement from the person, and then they can step in and fill their needs.
As you pointed out earlier, there's been a lot more research supporting the mind-body connection in the past 40 years, since you began your work. Is there any recent research that comes to mind that you find particularly important or hopeful?
Well, it's just, I'd say hopeful in the sense that there was a book by Bruce Lipton, The Biology of Belief. Now, he's a geneticist who agrees with me, and I agree with him, in that genes get a message and then act, what's called epigenetics. So, you know, see, I was criticized for this, understand, years ago, because I'd say to patients, what's happened in the last year or two in your life? And I was told, you're blaming your patient for getting sick? I'd say, no, I'm trying to understand why they might be vulnerable now. And that's why when a study like loneliness comes out, suddenly, oh, it's not crazy to ask somebody what's going on. And so his book really shares this. And to me, what it also says is, what does the treatment of the future need to be? It needs to be communication-type treatment so that if you have a disease, we'll say, okay, how can we communicate with the disease, alter its genes, give it a different message, and get it to behave itself? See, think about it from another perspective. If you and I were bacteria or viruses, and we're exposed to antibiotics and vaccines, what do? We alter our genes in order to resist what could kill us. See, that system is built into us too.
Yes.
But our lives are a lot more complicated. I mean, emotionally as well. So there are a lot of more mixed messages in us than I'm sure are in a bacteria or a virus. And when we can get to a therapeutic point and say, all right, let's communicate with a cancer cell, tell it to behave itself, stop doing this, mature, go back to normal, or just stop growing, that, I think, will be the treatment of the future rather than the kill, you know, burn, assault, cut out. It's let's heal the body and return it to normal.
Well, speaking of the treatment of the future, as you know, the healthcare debate is front and center in the U.S. right now. What's your take on what's right and what's wrong in healthcare today?
Well, I hate politics.
Me too.
I used the word potential earlier. Those are the best politicians, and a few of them are like that, meaning that, Kennedy used this term, our state representative, Rosa DeLauro, did, because she had cancer a few years ago, and we were both at a lecture as speakers. And I said to her, I can't stand politics. I always resign because all we do is have meetings, and all the good things you want to do never get done. And she said, Bernie, it's the potential. It can take 5 or 7 years. And that's what Kennedy said, too. He said, you know, it took me 5 years, 10 years sometimes to get things done, but they got done. And, boy, you got to be patient to be able to, you know, put up with that. And I think that, yes, we need health care. We need to let everybody know that they're entitled to health care, that we love them and care about them. And all the craziness. See, if I were in charge, if I were president, I would get much more into psychology of people. I always say I put on the, you know, income tax return. Why do you want to live another year? People put in a nice reason, because I want to do some good, see, rather than a selfish reason. I want to make more money. If they gave a selfish reason, I'd assign them to the Peace Corps for a year or raise their tax rate. If they gave a compassionate reason, I'd say good, and maybe reduce the tax rate. So what we need to do is reward health, number one. See, I can go all year not filling a prescription, not needing medical care except for a physical exam, and nobody does me a favor at the end of the year and says thank you and lowers my, you know, premium.
Mm, interesting, yeah.
So I'd say reward health.
Yeah.
We need to look at parenting so children grow up feeling loved so they're not self-destructive, because addiction, obesity, all of those things are not due to stupidity, you see. So if you love yourself, you don't become an addict. You take care of yourself. And so I'd say parenting is another significant public health issue. And in a sense, if we let everybody know we care, we are reparenting them. I saw that as a doctor, that self-destructive patients, if I kept seeing them rather than rejecting them like everybody else did, they began to take care of themselves. And I think when we can say to people, we care about you, we will take care of you, they'll begin to realize, hey, I'm worth something, so I got to take care of myself too. And I would reward research that, in other words, if you came up with an herb, say, that treats something, and you can't patent it, it's like, well, why the hell should I bother to spend money on research? Okay, then let's reward you tax-wise so that the government would also reward research and therapies that can't be patented, so, you know, you can make millions and billions of dollars on a new drug. Reward them for keeping people healthy, too, and finding ways of doing that that may not be big money makers, but could be money makers through the government.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're aware of the revolution that's been happening in psychology in the past 12 years or so. Have you been tracking what's known as positive psychology?
Well, you'd have to define it for me. I read more spiritual and psychological, you know, literature than I do the mechanical stuff.
Well, the good news is I think that the quotes traditional mechanical literature is beginning to more and more resemble the spiritual literature that you've been reading. That there's been a movement within psychology of people who are saying, you know, we focus too much on what's wrong with people and too much on pathology. Let's look at what leads to happiness.
You know, that's interesting, because when patients came into my office, I would always say, how can I help you? Not what's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But yet in the medical history, the formal history, you have a chief complaint. That's how it starts. And then
yes,
a present illness. So what's the first thing you ask a person to do? Complain. Say, what's wrong?
Yeah.
And I think, again, you focus on that versus how can I help you? What is it you're looking for? What's going on?
Mm-hmm.
And I found that when you treat the person's experience, some wonderful things happen, rather than the diagnosis. And in psychology, too, what I found was, if I said to people, how would you describe your illness? The words they use are always about their life. So if people are in pain, it's amazing how the words apply to what's increasing the pain. And words like draining, failure, confusion, pop out of them. And you say, how do those fit your life? Oh, and I say, yeah, use the darkness. Let it become a diamond. Let the disease help you heal your life, then they don't get so upset about their symptoms because they become something useful.
Mm-hmm.
And I may add, there are people who do say, yes, this is a gift and a blessing and a wake-up call and a new beginning. Those are words from people with cancer. And you'd say, how can they say that? Well, it's what it's led them to, see? And just as I said earlier, that cancer patients who laugh live longer, and they don't need humor, if you know what I mean. You laugh 3 or 4 times a day, because I love experimenting with it, I find if I start laughing out walking the dogs and just in the street and just start laughing, it's hard to stop, and I feel better.
I was just recently looking a bit into, there's this group in India, this fellow started laughter yoga, and he gets groups of people together just to laugh, and you can see videos of this on YouTube.
Yeah, I did that. You know, went to a class one weekend. And I was hysterical.
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't control my laughter. I mean, I'm sitting there just laughing uncontrollably for no reason. And it just seemed so crazy. But it was just fascinating to me how, in a sense, my mind and body took over and just went on doing this.
Yeah, it's got to be good for us, right?
Yeah. And this is what I would say to people, too. Don't Well, let me take a step back. I would say things to doctors, and they'd say, I can't accept that. And that used to drive me nuts. I said, look, if you can't explain it or understand it, okay, I can buy that. But why do you say I can't accept it? And it's because they've never been exposed to it. And I learned if I experience something, I accept it. So I try to become involved in the experience rather than say, oh, I believe in this, or I believe in that, or I heard about that. It's what do I experience? And I say to people, keep your minds open and experience life and various methods of healing. Because, again, if quantum physicists and astronomers couldn't accept what they can't explain, we'd be in big trouble. You know, you'd say, well, what's the point? How did the world get here? Who knows? And it's the intelligence behind it that fascinates me. Because when you read about quantum physics and astronomy, just think about, you know, things I never stopped to think about. If we took the moon away, what would happen to the Earth? If you move the Earth a few hundred miles closer to the sun, what would happen to the temperature and to us? And you think about, wow, you know, look at how it all worked out. What's behind it? And to me, again, I think our body is just as fascinating in the sense of what dwells within it. And really, if I had, again, if I were back to being the president, I'd spend all the money that we're spending in outer space on what I call inner space. I'd like to know what's going on in the body. See, let me bring up something that fascinated me. You remember the Lockerbie killer, the guy who blew up a plane,
yes,
killed 145 people and was in Scotland?
Yes.
And look, they learned he had cancer, and they said, okay, you can go home. You're going to be dead in a few months.
I didn't remember that part.
Yeah, he's already outlived the prediction. Because I wrote a letter to the editor in August saying that watch what happens to him when he goes home. See? And we haven't heard that he's dead or sick or anything else. Did the Scotch make a mistake? You're darn right. I mean, if they wanted to punish him for what he did, you don't send him home to compassion, see, and love and admiration.
Yeah, celebration, right.
Yeah, he becomes a hero.
Right.
And he's not going to die when he's supposed to, and he hasn't.
That's fascinating. Well, what you're getting at as you're talking about, you know, exploring the world within, maybe is the realm of spirit. Talk a little bit about spirit, because I know one of the things we want to talk about too is one of your 2005 book, 101 Exercises mm-hmm. for the Soul, has
right.
just come out in paper. So right. Let's talk a little bit about spirit and soul. Yeah. What are these yeah. words? What do these words mean
well,
to
let
you?
Me say, with that book is 365 prescriptions for the soul. And at the end of each is a solution, S-O-U-L. And then the 101 exercises was to give people ways of making that transformation. It's hard for me to define a word like spirit, but it's maybe self, you know, your true self, your spirit. Who are you? What are you here for? And what I'm trying to do is help people find that meaning. And that it's not whether you're here for 92 years or 29 years. It's what did I accomplish? What have I done? Have I shared love? Am I immortal now? And those are the things on a very practical level. In the book, there's I'm not sure if it's the first chapter or not. Let me open a page. But it's about attitude. You know, what's your attitude towards life and towards the world? Yeah, that's the first chapter. Attitude is everything. And here's the subtitle, My Sense of Humor. Don't sweat the small of the large stuff and save on the cost of deodorant. I don't know where that came from. But, but again, you see, it's you talk about happiness. I call it keeping that inner child alive. And the kid in me does things like this, you know, comes up with statements, you know, just very simply. When somebody says, see, this could be an exercise. You go to a store and they say, sign here. You know, if they take your credit card and fill out the slip, I write here on it. And, you know, people look at you.
Yeah.
But I've had a call from a lawyer saying, thank you. We rarely laugh early in the morning in a lawyer's office because I wrote all over this contract, here, 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 because he had all these stickers that said sign here. And, you know, he didn't get mad at me. He was happy to have laughed and then asked me for my autograph, which I gave him. But, you know, those, and another, about the word attitude, I met a man who had a pin with the word attitude. And he said that was how his wife helped him, because she would walk over to it, give it a spin, and say, honey, you need to straighten out your attitude. And she was his coach, but they were doing it in a way that, you know, would not offend him, like you're doing it wrong or don't you want to get well. And those are the things I think that people need to look at.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've got many topics there, from humor.
I'm glad you've got a copy of your book close at hand, because I was going to ask you if you'd be willing to maybe pick out two or three of your favorite exercises from the book.
Well, what I love to do, see, I leave it to consciousness. I'll just open the book right now. Exercise 20. And let me see what topic it's under. Yeah, vocal warm-ups. Find your voice and sing your song. And the one I won't do is give a speech, be heard. It starts with, there is no reason to have a voice unless you're going to use it. And, you know, when people are afraid, let me read what I wrote. As you get to know your voice through the exercise in this chapter, start using it to speak out. For this exercise, give a speech and share your ideas with others. And speaking out can be one of the hardest things to do because of how most of us were brought up. Parents and teachers told us to be quiet, not disturb anyone. And this is a true story. A woman who developed cancer, and I was helping her, and she sent me a letter saying her son came home from school and said, the teacher called me a disturbing element. No, wait a minute. I'm sorry, I got it wrong. It was something elephant. And when the mother went to school and said, why are you calling my son, you know, an elephant? She said, no, he's a bright kid, but he keeps speaking out. He's a disturbing element. And the disturbing element, what I found, if you want to survive in the hospital, you're better off being a disturbing element. Then you're someone that people know. You're not the submissive sufferer lying in a room, getting the wrong treatment, and perhaps dying due to a medical error. So, again, be heard. Speak out. And don't be afraid. It's not about what does the audience think. Because, you know, I do a lot of speaking now. I'm there to help. If somebody comes up to me and says, that was boring, I'm sorry. But the next person you see will come up and say, thank you, you inspired me. So what I've learned is what people hear and see in me is in them.
Yes.
And I look for people who think I'm wonderful because I know they're wonderful.
That's great. Well, I chose one at random here when you said that. And I chose just picking one at random. I've got exercise 51, pick a favorite animal qualities.
Mm-hmm.
And you write, the animal kingdom contains many diverse species, each with a distinct personality and unique abilities.
Right.
Though we may all have similar structures and colors on the inside, we are very different on the outside. I believe that is for recognition and to enhance our unique abilities, authenticity, and individuality. Do you already have a favorite animal? If not, think of one now. What animal do you relate to and admire because of its spiritual qualities and personality? Write down a list of characteristics and personality traits that attract you to this specific creature. Now read the list to the people who know you well and ask them, what do they think it describes? Right, it's you. You can think of this animal as your totem or special teacher. Emulate it in your life and call on it for guidance as needed.
Right.
As time goes on and you change, so may your totem animal take different forms.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're looking at the page. If you look to the left, to the previous page,
yeah.
I always teach people that when in doubt, when you aren't sure what the right thing to do is, to remember WWLD. In other words, what would Lassie do? And, you know, when you become the animal, you're really living as you should. I mean, because they always say the children, the animals are living in the moment, expressing their needs. And that's what we need to do. You know, when, again, you're the submissive sufferer, making your parents happy, not, internalizing your emotions, you make yourself vulnerable to illness. So speak out and learn from your animal. I had one young lady tell me that she was suicidal. And I said to her, what's your favorite animal? And she said, an eagle. I said, describe why. And she described this beautiful bird soaring through the air. And after a couple of minutes, she looked at me and said, I'm not going to commit suicide. I mean, you could see her become the eagle and sense this in herself.
Wow. Wow.
There's one other I got to share with you.
Good.
Exercise 59, page 112. Finding pennies. Look for symbols. To me, pennies have always been significant. Began to have some of the grandchildren say, oh, they're pennies from heaven. Because it's number one, it says liberty on it. Number two, in God we trust. And number three, you got Abe Lincoln looking to the east, but the poor guy has no smile. And that we all have to accept that, you know, what's going to happen to us is what happened to Lincoln. I mean, all our lives are going to end, so enjoy the time you have. But I really feel that you know, they don't have any great value, but it's like God telling me, hey, I'm dropping some crumbs, you'll know you're on the right path. So look for signs as you go through life. And I am amazed at how often pennies have, you know, are present in an airport, in my driveway, I mean, someplace. Some friends I know are going to run the marathon, a lady who's had polio, and she didn't know if she was going to make it. I said, look for pennies. And she found some, and it helped sustain her. And the first marathon I ran, which was to raise funds for lymphoma leukemia, I thought, I don't know if I'm going to make it. I need a sign. Standing, and this is in New York, 25,000 people. I'm standing there ready to begin. Look down. Between my feet was 25 cents, a quarter. Miles later, I'm running through the streets of New York. There's a penny. And the marathon's 26.
26, right. You got your 26 sign.
So I knew I couldn't stop because I'd get trampled. So I ran onto the sidewalk and circled back. And the funniest part were people saying, how poor can he be? You know, he's stopping to pick up a penny. But I still have that 26 cents. And once I found that, it was like, you're going to be okay. It may take me, I have to say, twice as long to finish as the person who wins, but I made it. And the other nice part, you know, when you talk about life, you finish the New York Marathon, they hang a medal around your neck. You know, you're all winners. And that's what one lady was saying, standing on a street corner, you're all winners. And that's what we need to understand.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, Bernie, you and I could go on and on, but
this
is a great place to wrap it up. So
all right.
I want to thank you so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure, Dave.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Bernie Siegel as much as I did. I hope I didn't come across as too much of a name dropper, but I felt a certain amount of excitement realizing that Bernie and I have been moving around in pretty much the same world for about the same length of time. Without knowing for certain, I had a strong sense as I was reading his book that he had probably been influenced by the Symingtons, who attracted a lot of attention in the 70s for their work using guided imagery with cancer patients. They were the ones who introduced the idea that patients should visualize their cancers and visualize their immune system sending out armies of attackers to destroy the cancer cells. Because of my own background in clinical hypnosis, I was also steeped in the work of Milton Erickson, who Bernie mentioned, and also in the work of another Ericksonian disciple, Dr. David Cheek, who found that patients had recall of things said in the operating room while they were under total anesthesia. Just as these sorts of findings were leading Bernie to write and lecture about mind and body being one, I was stimulated to develop a course at Sonoma State University called Psychology of the Body, which I taught for 25 years or more. For me, this class was a platform to try to articulate my own growing sense of mind-body wholeness, which has since become more and more widely accepted and written about. So although my own insights and efforts were far less visible than Bernie's, I definitely felt the kinship of a fellow traveler. Or to use a different metaphor, we've been swimming in the same soup. If you haven't read any of Bernie's books, they're all very inspirational, and I'm sure you'd enjoy any one or all of them. His website again is www.berniesiegelmd.com, and you'll find links there not only to his books, but to other resources as well.
Let us all come together to see what we can find. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Let us all remember what you seek is what you find. Dr. Davis here to remind you it's all in your mind.
Hello, everyone. I think I had mentioned that I was interviewed by a reporter from the American Psychological Association's monthly magazine, The Monitor. Well, the story has finally appeared in the February issue. They sent me some complimentary copies of the magazine, and it looks great. The article is titled Giving Psychology Away, One Podcast at a Time, which is a great title. The article covers not only Shrink Wrap Radio, but a couple of other psych-related podcasts as well. I've put a link to the article on the shrinkwrapradio.com website. You'll find it under the Promos tab at the top of the page. After 5 years of doing these podcasts, you can't imagine how gratifying it is to me to finally get on the APA's radar screen, even in this small way. And I'm happy to report that it looks like the American Psychological Association article has brought in some new listeners. If you're one of them, welcome. I hope you'll get hooked and become a subscriber and a participating member of our Shrink Wrap Radio community. Now, if only APA would become a sponsor for the show. I've been hard at work on my presentation for that International Market Research Conference in Prague that I mentioned. The conference is in May, but I want to make sure that I'm prepared well ahead of time. My presentation is titled Marketing and Happiness Through the Looking Glass of Positive Psychology. I'm working with a couple of people on the program committee, and I've just sent my PowerPoint off to them for their feedback. Here's hoping they find it on target. It's a bit of a stretch because the happiness research suggests that materialism and consumerism do not lead to happiness. And of course, I'm speaking to marketers, market researchers, and advertisers. I'll be appealing to my audience to work toward commerce that is oriented towards sustaining both the planet and human happiness. I'll keep you posted on this latest adventure as it unfolds. I just took a look at FeedBurner, and I see that I might have 8 listeners in the Czech Republic. So any Czechs who are listening, please send me an email, and perhaps we can get together over coffee or a beer in Prague. I'm not a big beer drinker, but I understand that the Czech Republic is home of some of the world's best beer. So I'll probably be adding a few pounds between the beer, the goulash, and the sausages, which they're also very well known for. Be sure to catch my interview with Nancy Rapoport, MD, on coming to terms with apparent suicide. Dr. Rapoport is a child psychiatrist. In our interview, she talks about her process of coming to terms with her mother's suicide, an event that occurred when she was 4 years old, which started when she herself became a mother and concludes 18 years later in the form of a book. You'll find this interview on my other series at wisecounselpodcast.com, where you'll also find a written transcript right on the page with the audio interview. Now, you might recall my mentioning that I've been looking for a good guest to talk about Jung's The Red Book. I approached Jungian analyst Dr. John Beebe, who I've interviewed twice before on Shrinkwrap Radio, and he's willing to speak with me about The Red Book, but he's asked to put our interview off until sometime in the summer so that he can have some time to digest this complex work and come to his own conclusions about it. I'm in the process of working on my taxes for 2009. And I see that the commercial spots, pre-roll ads, and sponsor ads that I ran last year brought in a total of $2,150. Now, as you know, I've decided to spare you having to listen to those ads. However, I must say that looking at the loss of a bit more than $2,000 a year is a bit sobering. I'm hoping that my appeals for your support through donations are less intrusive than those ads that I was running. Thanks to those of you who've made both one-time and continuing donations, and if you haven't made a donation, I hope you'll reinforce my decision to stop those ads by making a donation today. Just look for the big green donate button on our site. Now, if you have a cell phone, let me remind you that another way you can get these shows is through the Stitcher application, and you'll find a link to Stitcher on our website. And, of course, you can subscribe to it through iTunes, and there's a link to iTunes on our site as well. And especially for those of you who are new to this series, let me inform you that we have a Yahoo discussion group, and there's a banner link on our website in the right-hand sidebar. Or you can simply send an email to shrinkwrapradio-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. And finally, please remember to tell your friends, colleagues, family, and so on about Shrinkwrap Radio. I really appreciate it when you mention it on your blog, Facebook, or Twitter. And by the way, you can follow my tweets at twitter.com/shrinkwrapradio.
Hi, this is Richard Davidson. I'm a brain researcher at the University of Wisconsin, and I'm sitting here on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Richie Davidson. Dr. Davidson will be featured on my next episode, and I'm so excited about that. I've been trying to get that interview for months. He's such a high-profile figure in the world of brain research on meditation, and because of his busy schedule, there were several postponements. I feel lucky to have gotten him at all. Now to the mailbag. First, we hear from longtime listener and contributor Rick, who writes, "Hey Dave, I just wanted to let you know that I have recently completed my undergraduate program and am now applying for graduate school. Thanks for being my workout pal and exposing me to many different theoretical approaches." He's talking, I don't really work out with him, but he's talking about listening to the show while he's working out. He goes on to say, "I even have enjoyed the kind of wacky treatment paradigm some of your guests have brought to the table. Who knows, maybe I will come up with something that works but sounds a bit strange. Offbeat is so much more fun. Regards and happy holidays, Rick." And the happy holidays close there indicates how far behind I am in sharing these emails with you. Good luck to Rick in applying to graduate school. I know that you'll do well. Next, we hear from John in Ireland. Now, John had written previously to suggest an interview with James Hillman, and I replied to John that I'd seen Hillman some years back, and I was put off by what I experienced as his arrogance. I asked John if he had contact info for Hillman, and he replied with the following, "Dr. Dave, greetings of the season to you." Again, you can tell how far behind I am. "No, don't have an inroad to Hillman myself, but Thomas Moore might make a good starting point as an interpreter, once removed, who might not be infected with some of the flaws you mentioned. Perhaps you describe a version of the wounded healer in The Great Man, a bit like the chap, who was it, Scott M. Peck, who could write all right books while living the wrong life, etc." You know, I don't know any of the history of Scott Peck's life. I do know his books. He goes on to say Moore is an anthologist of Hillman's, Blue Fire, I think, being a selection of his writings. Keep up the good work. A great, great show, John. And next we hear from Viral, who writes, Hi, Dr. Dave. I never really paid attention to your transcript volunteering until today. I would like to volunteer. I noticed that every transcript is in PDF format. How is that done? Would I be able to just use Microsoft Word and email it to somebody who can convert it? If nobody's doing it, I would like to do transcript for Secrets of the Bulletproof Spirit by Azeem Kamisa. Thanks, and that's from Viral. And what people do, the transcribers do, is they send me a Word file, and then I convert it to PDF, and I put it up there. And Viral has since gone ahead and done this transcription, and it's one of the really great interviews with Azeem Kamisa, Secrets of the Bulletproof Spirit. You'll find that in the transcripts area on our site. And here's another transcription offer from Bob, who writes, Dr. Dave, I have for some time felt that I should contribute to the community by volunteering to transcribe. Since I suggested your guest for number 226, Dream Sight with Jane Teresa Anderson, I would be interested in transcribing that one if you haven't already got someone starting on this one. I worry about my timing for completion. I will try to get some done now over the holidays, but I may be a while finishing. Is that okay, Bob? And yes, Bob, that's okay, and Bob's working on it. We don't have it yet, so true to his word, it is taking some time. We're almost mid-February, Bob, so if you're listening to this, get on the stick, and I will be happy to get it whenever you get it to me. Here's another one from Rick to wrap things up. Hey, Dave, tonight I listened to the Stephen Hayes interview on Wise Counsel while I was on my walk. What an incredibly rich interview. A talent you have that very few talk show hosts have is the intuitive sense of when to shut up and allow the guests to expand on their ideas. Inversely, you seem to sense when to interject with your guest because an idea needs clarification or to be momentarily rested upon a bed of softer language. Kudos to you, mate. I also wanted to mention that I purchased David Wallen's book on attachment because I have a feeling, God willing, that it will inform my future clinical practice. I can't wait to begin graduate school. I'm very excited. Anyhow, I thought you might want to pass along to Wallen that he sold another book as a direct result of his choice to interview you. God bless, Rick the Insomniac. And I did pass that on to Wallen. I really need to have a bookstore sponsor, don't I? Because so many of you buy books. Well, I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. In addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, which nobody has done in a long time. Our name there is ShrinkPod, and nobody has left me a voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to my guest, Bernie Siegel, MD, for sharing about his groundbreaking work with cancer patients and his book on 101 Exercises for the Soul. And as I mentioned before, my next show will feature an interview I've been very excited about. It's with Dr. Richard Davidson, who has conducted pioneering research on the effects of meditation on the brain. You won't want to miss it. Until next time, then. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.